Chapter 11, Ourselves in the Divine Offering. If we have grasped the principle I have endeavored to state in the last chapter, we shall find that with this new standpoint, a new life and a new world begin to open out to us. This is because we are now living from a new recognition of ourselves and of God. Eternal truth, that which is the essential reality of being, is always the same. It has never altered. For whatever is capable of passing away and giving place to something else is not eternal. And therefore, the real essence of our being, as proceeding from God and subsisting in Him, has always been the same. But this is the very fact which we have hitherto lost sight of, and since our perception of life is the measure of our individual consciousness of it, we have imposed upon ourselves a world of limitation, a world filled with the power of the negative, because we have viewed things from that standpoint. What takes place, therefore, when we realize the truth of our redemption, is not a change in our essential relation to the parent spirit, the eternal Father, but an awakening to the perception of this eternal and absolutely perfect relation. We see that in reality it has never been otherwise, for the simple reason that in the very nature of being, it could not be otherwise. And when we see this, we see also that what has hitherto been wrong has not been the working of the Father, but our conception of the existence of some other power, a power of negation, limitation, and destructiveness, the very opposite of all to all that the creative spirit, by the very fact of its creativeness, must be. That wonderful parable of the prodigal son shows us that he never ceased to be a son. It was not his father who sent him away from home, but his notion that he could do better on his own. And we all know what came of it. But when he returned to the Father, he found that from the Father's point of view, he had never been otherwise than a son, and that all the trouble he had gone through was not of the Father, but was the result of his own failure to realize what the Father and the home really were. Now, this is exactly the case with ourselves. When we wake up to the truth, we find that, so far as the Father is concerned, we have always been in Him and in His home, for we are made in His image and likeness and are reflections of His own being. He says to us, "Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine." The self-contemplation of spirit is the creative power creating an environment corresponding to the mode of consciousness contemplated. And therefore, in proportion as we contemplate ourselves as centers of individualization for the divine spirit, we find ourselves surrounded by a new environment reflecting the harmonious conditions which pre-exist in the thought of the spirit. This, then, is the sequence of cause and effect involved in the teaching of the Bible. Man is in essence a spiritual being, the reflection on the plane of individual personality of that which the all-originating spirit is in itself, and is thus in that reciprocal relation to the spirit which is love. This is the first statement of his creation in Genesis. God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good, man included. Then the fall is the failure of the lower mentality to realize that God is love. In a word, that love is the only ultimate motive power it is possible to conceive, and that the creations of love cannot be otherwise than good and beautiful. The lower mentality conceives an opposite quality of evil, and thus produces a motive, the opposite power, the opposite of love, which is fear. And so fear is born into the world, giving rise to the whole brood of evil, anger, hatred, envy, lies, violence, and the like, and on the external plane, giving rise to discordant vibrations, which are the root of physical ill. If we analyze our motives, we shall find that they are always some mode either of love or fear. And fear has its root in the recognition of some power other than perfect love, which is God, the one all-embracing good. Fear has a creative force which invertedly mimics that of love. But the difference between them is that love is eternal and fear is not. Love is the original creative motive, is the only logical conclusion we can come to as to why we ourselves or any other creation exists. Fear is illogical, because to regard it as having any place in the original creative motion, involves a contradiction in terms. By accepting the notion of a dual power, that of good and evil, the inverted creative working of fear is introduced, with all its attendant train of evil things. This is the eating of the deadly tree which occasions the fall, and therefore the redemption which requires to be accomplished is a redemption from fear, not merely from this or that particular fear, but from the very root of fear, which root is unbelief in the love of God. The refusal to believe that love alone is the creative power in all things, whether small beyond our recognition or great beyond our conception. Therefore, to bring about this redemption, there must be such a manifestation of the divine love to man as, when rightly apprehended, will leave no ground for fear. And when we see that the sacrifice of the cross was the self-offering of love, made in order to provide this manifestation, then we see that all the links in the chain of cause and effect are complete, and that fear never had any place in the creative principle, whether as acting in the creation of a world or of a man. The root, therefore, of all the trouble of the world consists in the affirmation of negation, in using our creative power of thought invertedly, and thus giving substance to that which as principle has no existence. So long as this negative action of thought continues, so long will it produce its natural effect, whether in the individual or in the mass. The experience is perfectly real while it lasts. Its unreality consists in the fact that there was never any real need for it. And the more we grasp the truth of the all-embracingness of the one good, both as cause and as effect on all planes, the more the experience of its opposite will cease to have any place in our lives. This truly new thought puts us in an entirely new relation to the whole of our environment, opening out possibilities hitherto undreamt of. And this, by an orderly sequence of law which is naturally involved in our new mental attitude. But before considering the prospect thus offered, it is well to be quite clear as to what this new mental attitude really is. For it is our adoption of this attitude that is the key to the whole position. Put briefly, it is ceasing to include the idea of limitation in our conception of the working of the all-creating spirit. Here are some specimens of the way in which we limit the creative working of the spirit. We say, I am too old now to start this or that new sort of work. This is to deny the power of the spirit to vivify our physical or mental faculties, which is illogical if we consider that it is the same spirit that brought us into any existence at all. It is like saying that when a lamp is beginning to burn low, the same person who first filled it with oil cannot replenish it and make it burn brightly again. Or we say, I cannot do so and so because I have not the means. When you were 14, did you know where all the means were coming from, which are going to support you till now, when you are perhaps 40 or 50? So you should argue that the same power that has worked in the past can continue to work in the future. If you say, the means came in the past quite naturally through ordinary channels, that is an objection. On the contrary, the more reason for saying that suitable channels will open in the future. Do you expect God to put cash into your desk by a conjuring trick? Means come through recognizable channels. That is to say, we recognize the channels by the fact of the stream flowing through them. And one of our most common mistakes is in thinking that we ourselves have to fix the particular channel beforehand. We say, in effect, that the spirit cannot open other channels, and so we stop them up. Or we say, our past experience speaks to the contrary, thus assuming that our past experiences have included all possibilities and have exhausted the laws of the universe, an assumption which is negatived by every fresh discovery, even in physical science. And so we go on limiting the power of spirit in 100 different ways. But careful consideration will show that though the modes in which we limit it are as numerous as the circumstances with which we have to deal, the thing with which we limit it is always the same. It is by the introduction of our own personality. This may appear at first a direct contradiction of all that I have said about the necessity for the personal factor, but it is not. Here is a paradox. To open out into manifestation the wonderful possibilities hidden in the creative power of the universe, we require to do two things: to see that we ourselves are necessary as centers for focusing that power, and at the same time to withdraw the thought of ourselves as contributing anything to its efficiency. It is not I that work, but the power. Yet, the power needs me, because it cannot specialize itself without me. In a word, each is a complementary of the other. And the higher the degree of specialization is to be, the more necessary is the intelligent and willing cooperation of the individual. This is the scriptural paradox, that the Son can do nothing of himself, and yet we are told to be fellow workers with God. It ceases to be a paradox, however, when we realize the relation between the two factors concerned, God and man. Our mistake is in not discriminating between their respective functions and putting man in the place of God. In our everyday life, we do this by measuring the power of God by our past experiences and the deductions we draw from them. But there is another way of putting man in the place of God, and that is by the misconception that the all-originating spirit is merely a cosmic force without intelligence, and that man has to originate the intelligence without which no specific purpose can be conceived. This latter is the error of much of the present-day philosophy and has to be specially guarded against. This was perceived by some of the medieval students of these things, and they accordingly distinguished between what they called animus dea and anima mundi, the divine spirit and the soul of the universe. Now, the distinction is this, that the essential quality of animus dea is personality, not a person, but the very principle of personality itself, while the essential quality of anima mundi is impersonality. Then right here comes in that importance of the personal factor of which I have already spoken. The powers latent in the impersonal are brought out to their fullest development by the operation of the personal. This, of course, does not consist in changing the nature of those powers, for that is impossible, but in making such combinations of them by personal selection as to produce results which could not otherwise be obtained. Thus, for example, number is in itself impersonal, and no one can alter the laws which are inherent in it. But what we can do is to select particular numbers and the sort of relations such as subtraction, multiplication, etc., which we will establish between them. And then, by the inherent law of number, a certain result is bound to work out. Now, our own essential quality is the consciousness of personality. And as we grow into the recognition of the fact that the impersonal is, as it were, crying out for the operation upon it of the personal in order to bring its latent powers into working, we shall see how limitless is the field that thus opens before us. The prospect is wonderful beyond our present conception, and full of increasing glory if we realize the true foundation on which it rests. But herein lies the danger. It consists in not realizing that the infinite of the impersonal is, and also that the infinite of the personal is. Both are infinite, and so require differentiation through our own personality. But in their essential quality, each is the exact balance of the other, not in contradiction to each other, but as complementary to one another, each supplying what the other needs for its full expression, so that the two together make a perfect whole. If, however, we see this relation and our own position as the connecting link between them, we shall see only ourselves as the personal factor. But the more we realize, both by theory and experience, the power of human personality brought into contact with the impersonal soul of nature, and employed with a knowledge of its power and a corresponding exercise of the will, the less we shall be inclined to regard ourselves as the supreme factor in the chain of cause and effect. Consideration of this argument points to the danger of much of the present day teaching regarding the exercise of thought power as a creative agency. The principle on which this teaching is based is sound and legitimate, for it is inherent in the nature of things. But the error is in supposing that we ourselves are the ultimate source of personality, instead of merely the distributors and specializers of it. The logical result of such a mental attitude is that, putting ourselves in the place of all that is worshipped as God, which is spoken of in the second chapter of the second epistle to the Thessalonians and other parts of Scripture, by the very hypothesis of the case, we then know no higher will than our own, and so are without any unifying principle to prevent the conflict of wills, which must then arise, a conflict which must become more and more destructive, the greater the power possessed by the contending parties, and which, if there were no counterbalancing power, must result in the ultimate destruction of the existing race of man. But there is a counterbalancing power. It is the very same power used affirmatively instead of negatively. It is the power of the personal with the impersonal when used under the guidance of that unifying principle which the recognition of the oneness of the personal quality in the divine spirit supplies. Those who are using the creative power of thought only from the standpoint of individual personality have obviously less power than those who are using it from the standpoint of the personality inherent in the living spirit, which is the source and fountain of all energy and substance. And therefore, in the end, the victory must remain with those latter. And because the power by which they conquer is that of the unifying personality itself, their victory must result in the establishment of peace and happiness throughout the world, and is not a power of domination, but of helpfulness and enlightenment. The choice is between these two mottos: each for himself and devil take the hindmost, and God for us all. In proportion, therefore, as we realize the immense forces dormant in the impersonal soul of nature, only awaiting the introduction of the personal factor to wake them up into activity and direct them to specific purposes, the wider we shall find the scope of the powers within the reach of man, and the more clearly we perceive the impersonalness of the very principle of personality itself, the clearer our own proper position as affording the differentiating medium between these two infinitudes will become to us. The impersonalness of the principle of personality looks like a contradiction in terms, but it is not. I combine these two seemingly contradictory terms as the best way to convey to the reader the idea of the essential quality of personality, not yet differentiated into individual centers of consciousness for the doing of particular work. Looked at in this way, the infinite of personality must have unity of purpose for its foundation, for otherwise it would consist of conflicting personalities, in which case we have not yet reached the one all-originating cause. Or, to put it in another way, an infinite personality divided against itself would be an infinite insanity, a creator of a cosmic bedlam, which, as a scientific fact, would be impossible of existence. Therefore, the conception of an infinite of personality necessarily implies a perpetual unity of purpose, and for the same reason, this purpose can only be the fuller and fuller expression of an infinite unity of consciousness, and unity of consciousness necessarily implies the entire absence of all that would impair it, and therefore its expression can only be as universal harmony. If, then, the individual realizes this true nature of the source from which his own consciousness of personality is derived, his ideas and work will be based upon this foundation, with the result that, as between ourselves, peace and goodwill towards men must accompany this mode of thought, and as between us and the strictly impersonal soul of nature, our increasing knowledge in that direction would mean increasing power for carrying out our principle of peace and goodwill. As this perception of our relation to the Spirit of God and the soul of nature spreads from individual to individual, so the kingdom of God will grow, and its universal recognition would be the establishing of the kingdom of heaven on earth. Perhaps the reader will ask why I say the soul of nature instead of saying the material universe. The reason is that in using our creative power of thought, we do not operate directly upon material elements. To do this is the work of construction from without and not of creation from within. The whole tendency of modern physical science is to reduce all matter in the final analysis to energy working in a primary ether. Whence this energy and this ether proceed is not the subject of physical analysis. That is a question which cannot be answered by means of the vacuum tube or the spectroscope. Physical science is doing its legitimate work in pushing further and further back the unanalyzable residuum of nature, but however far back, an ultimate unanalyzable residuum there must always be. And when physical science brings us to this point, it hands us over to the guidance of psychological investigation, just as in the Divina Commedia, Virgil transfers Dante to the guidance of Beatrice for the study of the higher realms. Various rates of rapidity of motion in this primary ether, producing various numerical combinations of positively and negatively electrified particles, result in the formation of what we know as the different chemical elements, and this explains the phenomena of their combining quantities, the law by which they join together to form new substances, only in certain exact numerical ratios. From the first movement in the primary ether, two solid substances such as wood or iron or our own flesh is thus a series of vibrations in a succession of mediums, each denser than the preceding one, out of which it was concreted and from which it receives the vibratory impulse. This is, in effect, what physical science has to tell us. But to get further back, we must look into the world of the invisible, and it is here that psychological study comes to our aid. We cannot, however, study the invisible side of nature by working from the outside. And so at this point of our studies, we find the use of the time-honored teaching regarding the parallelism between the macrocosm and the microcosm. If the microcosm is the reproduction in ourselves of the same principles as exist in the macrocosm or universe in which we have our being, then by investigating ourselves, we shall learn the nature of the corresponding invisible principles in our environment. Here, then, is the application of the dictum of the ancient philosophy, "Know thyself." It means that the only place where we can study the principles of the invisible side of nature is in ourselves. And when we know them there, we can transfer them to the larger worlds around us. In the concluding chapters of my Edinburgh lectures on mental science, I have outlined the way in which the soul or mind operates upon the physical instrument of its expression, and it resolves itself into this: that the mental action inaugurates a series of vibration in the etheric body, which, in their turn, induce corresponding grosser vibrations in the molecular substance, until finally mechanical action is produced on the outside. Now, transferring this idea to nature as a whole, we shall see that if our mental action is to affect it in any way, it can only be by the response of something at the back of material substance, analogous to mind in ourselves, and that there is such a something interior to the merely material side of nature is proved by what we may call the law of tendency, not only in animals and plants, but even in inorganic substances, as shown, for instance, in Professor Bose's work on the response of metals. The universal presence of this law of tendency therefore indicates the working of some non-material and, so to say, semi-intelligent power in the material world, a power which works perfectly accurately on its own lines so far as it goes, that is to say, in a generic manner, but which does not possess that personal power of individual selection, which is necessary to bring out the infinite possibilities hidden in it. This is what is meant by the soul of nature, and it is for this reason I employ that term instead of saying the material universe. Which term to employ all depends on the mode of action we are contemplating. If it is construction from without, then we are dealing with the purely material universe. If we are seeking to bring about results by the exercise of our mental power from within, then we are dealing with the soul of nature. It is that control of the lower degree of intelligence by the higher, of which I have spoken in my Edinburgh lectures. If we realize what I have endeavored to make clear in the earlier portion of this book, that the whole creation is produced by the operation of the divine will upon the soul of nature, it will be evident that we can set no limits to the potencies hidden in the latter, and capable of being brought out by the operation of the personal factor upon it. Therefore, granted a sufficiently powerful concentration of will, whether by an individual or a group of individuals, we can well imagine the production of stupendous effects by this agency. And in this way, I would explain the statements made in Scripture regarding the marvelous powers to be exercised by the Antichrist, whether personal or collective. They are psychic powers, the power of the soul of man over the soul of nature. But the soul of nature is quite impersonal, and therefore the moral quality of this action depends entirely on the human operator. This is the point of the Master's teaching regarding the destruction of the fig tree, and it is on this account he adds the warning as to the necessity for clearing our heart of any injurious feeling against others whenever we attempt to make use of this power. Mark 11:20-26. According to his teaching, then, this power of controlling the soul of nature by the addition of our own personal factor, however little we may be able to recognize it as yet, actually exists. Its employment depends on the perception of the inner principles common to both, and it is for this reason the ancient wisdom was summed up in the aphorism, "Know thyself." No doubt it is a wonderful knowledge, but on analysis it will be found to be perfectly natural. It is the knowledge of the cryptic forces of nature. Now, it is remarkable that this ancient maxim inscribed over the portals of the Temple of Delphi is not to be found in the Bible. The Bible maxim is not "know thyself," but "know the Lord." The great subject of knowledge is not ourself, but the Lord. And herein is the great difference between the two teachings. The one is limited by human personality. The other is based on the infinitude of the divine personality. And because of this, it includes human personality with all its powers over the soul of nature. It is a case of the greater including the less. And so the whole teaching of Scripture is directed to bringing us into the recognition of that divine personality, which is the great original, in whose image and likeness we are made. In proportion as we grow into the recognition of this, our own personality will explain, and The creative power of our thought will cease to work invertedly until at last it will work only on the same principles of life, love, and liberty as the divine mind. And so all evil will disappear from our world. We shall not, as some systems teach, be absorbed into deity to the extinction of our individual consciousness, but on the contrary, our individual consciousness will continually expand, which is what St. Paul means when he speaks of our increasing with the increase of God, the continual expanding of the divine element within us. But this can only take place by our recognition of ourselves as receivers of this divine element. It is receiving into ourselves of the divine personality, a result not to be reached through human reasoning. We reason from premises which we have assumed, and the conclusion is already involved in the premises and can never extend beyond them. But we can only select our premises from among things that we know by experience, whether mental or physical, and accordingly, our reasoning is always merely a new placing of the old things. But the receiving of the divine personality into ourselves is an entirely new thing, and so cannot be reached by reasoning from old things. Hence, if this divine ultimate of the creative process is to be attained, it must be by the revelation of a new thing, which will afford a new starting point for our thought. And this new starting point is given in the promise of, quote, the seed of the woman, unquote, with which the Bible opens. Thenceforward, this promise became the central germinating thought of those who based themselves upon it, thus constituting them a special race, until at last, when the necessary conditions had matured, the promised seed appeared in him of whom it is written that he is the express image of God's person. Hebrews 1:3. That is, the expression of that infinite divine personality of which I have spoken. Quote, no man hath seen God at any time, nor can we see him, end quote, for the simple reason that infinitude cannot be the subject of vision. To become visible, there must be individualization. And therefore, when Philip said, show us the Father, Jesus replied, he that hath seen me hath seen the Father. The Word must become flesh before St. John could say that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled, of the Word of life. This is the new starting point for the true new thought, the new Adam of the new race, each of whom is a new center for the working of the divine spirit. This is what Jesus meant when he said, except ye eat the flesh and drink the blood of the Son of Man, ye have no life in you. My flesh is meat indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. Such a contemplation of the divine personality in him will cause a like receiving of the divine personality into individualization in ourselves. This is the great purpose of the creative process in the individual. It terminates the old series, which began with birth after the flesh, and inaugurates a new series by birth after the Spirit, a new life of infinite unfoldment with glorious possibilities beyond our highest conception. But all this is logically based upon our recognition of the personalness of God and of the relation of our individual personality to this eternal and infinite personality. And the result of this is worship, not in an attempt to butter up the Almighty and get him into good temper, but the reverent contemplation of what this personality must be in itself. And when we see it to be that life, love, beauty, etc., of which I spoke at the beginning of this book, we shall learn to love him for what he is, and our prayer will be, "Give me more of thyself." If we realize the great truth that the kingdom of heaven is within us, that it is the kingdom of the innermost of our own being and of all creation, and if we realize that this innermost is the place of the originating power, where time and space do not exist, and there antecedent to all conditions, then we shall see the true meaning of worship. It is the perception of the innermost Spirit as eternally subsisting independently of all conditioned manifestation, so that in the true worship, our consciousness is removed from the outer sphere of existence to the innermost center of unconditioned being. There we find the eternal being of God, pure and simple. And we stand reverently in this supreme presence, knowing that it is the source of our own being. And wrapped in the contemplation of this, the conditioned is seen to flow out from it. Perceiving this, the conditioned passes out of our consideration, for it is seen not to be the eternal reality. We have reached that level of consciousness where time and space remain no longer. Yet, the reverence which the vision of this supreme center of all being cannot fail to inspire is coupled with a sense of feeling quite at home with it. This is because, as the center of all being, it is the center of our own being also. It is one with ourselves. It is recognizing itself from our own center of consciousness, so that here we have got back to that self-contemplation of Spirit, which is the first movement of the creative power. Only now, this self-contemplation is the action of the all-originating Spirit upon itself from the center of our own consciousness. So this worship in the temple of the innermost is at once reverent adoration and familiar intercourse, not the familiarity that breeds contempt, but a familiarity producing love, because as it increases, we see more clearly the true life of the Spirit as the continual interaction of love and beauty, and the Spirit's recognition of ourselves as an integral portion of its own life. This is not an unpractical, dreamy speculation, but has a very practical bearing. Death will someday cease to be, for the simple reason that life alone can be the enduring principle, but we have not yet reached this point in our evolution. Whether any in this generation will reach it, I cannot say, but for the rank and file of us, the death of the body seems to be by far the more probable event. Now, what must this passing out of the body mean to us? It must mean that we find ourselves without the physical vehicle, which is the instrument through which our consciousness comes in touch with the external world and all the interests of our present-day life. But the mere putting off of the body does not, of itself, change the mental attitude. And so if our mind is entirely centered upon these passing interests and external conditions, the loss of the instrument by which we held touch with them must involve a consciousness of desire for the only sort of life we have known, coupled with a consciousness of our inability to participate in it, which can only result in a consciousness of distress and confusion, such as in our present state we cannot imagine. On the other hand, if we have in this world realized the true principle of the worship of the eternal source from which all conditioned life flows out, an inner communing with the great reality, we have already passed beyond that consciousness of life which is limited by time and space, and so when we put off this mortal body, we shall find ourselves upon familiar ground, and therefore not wandering in confusion, but quite at home, dwelling in the same light of the eternal in which we have been accustomed to dwell, as an atmosphere enveloping the conditioned life of today. Then, finding ourselves thus at home on a plane where time and space do not exist, there will be no question with us of duration. The consciousness will be simply that of peaceful, happy being. That a return to more active personal operation will eventually take place is evidenced by the fact that the basis of all further evolution is the differentiating of the undifferentiated life of the spirit into specific channels of work through the intermediary of individual personality, without which the infinite potentialities of the creative law cannot be brought to light. Therefore, however various our opinions as to its precise form, resurrection as a principle is a necessity of the creative process. But such a return to more active life will not mean a return to limitations, but the opening of a new life in which we shall transcend them all, because we have passed beyond the misconception that time and space are of the essence of life. When the misconception regarding time and space is entirely eradicated, all other limitations must disappear, because they have their root in the primary one. They are only particular forms of the general proposition. Therefore, though form with its accompanying relations of time and space is necessary for manifestation, these things will be found not to have any force in themselves, thus creating limitation, but to be the reflection of the mode of thought which projects them as the expression of itself. Nor is there any inherent reason why this process should be delayed until some far-off future. There is no reason why we should not commence at once. No doubt our inherited and personally engendered modes of thought make this difficult, and by the nature of the process, it will be only when all our thoughts are conformed to this principle that the complete victory will be won. But there must be a commencement to everything, and the more we habituate ourselves to live in that center of the innermost, where conditions do not exist, the more we shall find ourselves gaining control over outward conditions, because the stream of conditioned life flows out from the center of unconditioned life. And therefore, this intrinsic principle of worship has in it the promise both of the life that now is and of that which is to come. Only we must remember that the really availing worship is that of the undifferentiated source, because it is the source, and not as a backhanded way of diverting the stream into some petty channel of conditions, for that would only be to get back to the old circle of limitation from which we are seeking to escape. But if we realize these things, we have already laid hold of the principle of resurrection, and in point of principle, we are already living the resurrection life. What progress we may make in it depends on our practical application of the principle, but simply as principle. There is nothing in the principle itself to prevent its complete working at any moment. That is why Jesus did not refer resurrection to some remote point of time, but said, "I am the resurrection and the life." No principle can carry in itself an opposite and limiting principle, contradictory of its own nature. And this is as true of the principle of life as any other principle. It is we who, by our thought, introduce an opposite and limiting principle, and so hinder the working of the principle we are seeking to bring into operation. But so far as the principle of life itself is concerned, there is in it no reason why it should not come into perfect manifestation here and now. This, then, is the true purpose of worship. It is to bring us into conscious and loving intercourse with the supreme source of our own being. And seeing this, we shall not neglect the outward forms of worship. From what we now know, they should mean more to us than to others, and not less. And in especial, if we realize the manifestation of the divine personality in Jesus Christ and its reproduction in man, we shall not neglect his last command to partake of that sacred memorial to his flesh and blood, which he bequeathed to his followers with the words, "This do in remembrance of me." This holy rite is no superstitious human invention. There are many theories about it, and I do not wish to combat any of them, for in the end they all seem to me to bring us to the same point, that being cleansed from sin by the divine love, we are now no longer separate from God, but become partakers of the divine nature. This partaking of the divine nature could not be more accurately represented than by our partaking of bread and wine as symbols of the divine substance and the divine life, thus made emblematic of the whole creative process from its beginning in the divine thought to its contemplation, completion in the manifestation of that thought as perfected man. And so it brings vividly before us the remembrance of the personality of God taking form as the Son of Man. We are all familiar with the saying that thoughts become things. And if we affirm the creative power of our own thought as reproducing itself in outward form, how much more must we affirm the same of that divine thought which brings the whole universe into existence, so that in accordance with our own principles, the divine idea of man was logically bound to show itself in the world of time and space as the Son of God and the Son of Man, not two differing natures, but one complete whole. Thus, summing up the foundation principle of all creation in one undivided consciousness of personality. Thus, the Word, or divine thought of man, became flesh, and our partaking of the symbolic elements keeps in our remembrance the supreme truth that this same Word or thought of God, in like manner, takes form in ourselves as we open our own thought to receive it. And further, if we realize that throughout the universe there is only one originating life, sending forth only one original substance as the vehicle for its expression, then it logically follows that, in essence, the bread is a portion of the eternal substance of God, and the wine a portion of the eternal life of God. For though the wine is, of course, also a part of the universal substance, we must remember that the universal substance is itself a manifestation of the life of the all-creating spirit, and therefore this fluid form of the primary substance has been selected as representing the eternal flowing of the life of the spirit into all creation, culminating in its supreme expression in the consciousness of those who, in the recognition of these truths, seek to bring their heart into union with the divine spirit. From such considerations as these, it will be seen how vast a field of thought is covered by Christ's words, "Do this in remembrance of me." In conclusion, therefore, do not let yourselves be led astray by any philosophy that denies the personality of God. In the end, it will be found to be a foolish philosophy. No other starting point of creation is conceivable than the self-contemplation of the divine spirit. And the logical sequence from this brings us to the ultimate result of the creative process in the statement that if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Or, as the margin has it, a new creation. 2 Corinthians 5:17. Such vain philosophies have only one logical result, which is to put yourself in the place of God. And then what have you to lean upon in the hour of trial? It is like trying to climb up a ladder that is resting against nothing. Therefore, says the Apostle Paul, beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of man, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ. Colossians 2:8. The teaching of the Bible is sound philosophy, sound reasoning, and sound science, because it starts with the sound premises that all creation proceeds out of God, and that man is made in the image and likeness of his Creator. It nowhere departs from the law of cause and effect, and by the orderly sequence of this law, it brings us at last to the new creation, both in ourselves and in our environment, so that we find the completion of the creative process in the declaration, quote, "The tabernacle of God is with men," end quote. Revelation 21:3. And in the promise, quote, "This is the covenant that I will make with them after those days," meaning the days of our imperfect apprehension of these things, saith the Lord, "I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people, and I will put my laws into their hearts, and in their minds I will write them, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. End quote. Hebrews 10:16, 2 Corinthians 6:16, Jeremiah 31:33. Truly, does Bacon say, a little philosophy inclineth the mind's man to atheism, but depth in philosophy bringeth men's minds about to religion. That's the end of the book. Thank you.